Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Marcia Gugliardi, founder of the weekly e-column tablehopper.com and author of The Tablehopper's Guide to Dining and Drinking in San Francisco. Tonight we are joined by four James Beard Foundation Award winners: Joshua Adlin, co-owner, architect, and designer at Adlin Darling Design, and winner of Outstanding Restaurant Design for Bar Agricole; Charles Fan, owner and chef of The Slanted Door, and winner of Who's Who of Food and Beverage and America Inductees; Michael Tusk, chef and owner at Quince and Catonia, and winner of Best Chef in the Region; and Paolo Lucchesi, author of The Inside Scoop at the San Francisco Chronicle, which won Best Food Section. So we're all here to address the question, what makes a restaurant great? People often say they love a restaurant or it's one of their favorites, but tonight we're here to talk about great restaurants, the places that aren't just offering good food or a unique experience or the latest, hottest dish or chef, but are truly great. So let's dive in. So restaurant critics base their reviews on the food, service, and the atmosphere decor, with some attention paid to the wine list. And then there's that X factor. What percentage do you weigh each core component in terms of importance, the food, service, and atmosphere, adding up to 100%? Michael? Paolo?
I think everything is important when you're trying to put on a restaurant experience. From start to finish, the moment that guests walk in the door these days, you need to think about pretty much everything. And so I came from a background of having studied art history, so I liked and I always liked design. So that part of opening a restaurant was very interesting to me. And, of course, from being a chef, obviously the food was important. So I think that's, if you're a restaurant owner, all of it is very important, so you should enjoy each process that goes into the experience the guest is going to have when they walk in through the, not even when they walk in through the door, but when they're driving up to the restaurant. You have to hopefully think about everything.
Thank you. So I'd like to drill down to some of the basics, and I think we might as well start with everyone's favorite topic, food. So I'd like to know, and I'd like to hear from each of you, what makes good food great? You know, there's taste, the quality of ingredients, presentation. What are other qualities that come to mind when you think of great food? Charles?
Well, when I was asked to talk about it, it's kind of scary. You're in San Francisco and you're going to say, which one's a great restaurant? I didn't name his restaurant. He's going to kick me right now, right? and I think of it, often actually starts with a reputation. You know, how do you generate that reputation? Start getting people to talk about your restaurant. And it could be just a little hole in the wall place. And I brought somebody, a friend, to a hole in the wall place, and they say, well, how did you find out about this? And sometimes I don't even know how these things kind of goes around. And it sets a tone. And often I remember when we were first open, I only knew how to make a few things, and we opened and it wasn't ready. But we get this buzz, and we had to play catch up a lot. And I think there's, you've got the right bone, the right structure, you could really, it's that magical moment where you really get over that hump of making, and the restaurant continues successful. Once you get successful, you make more mistake, and you get better at the food gets better. That's how it works, you know. So, and I don't think a lot of people look at that. But I think if you have a right location, right bone, obviously you got to cook good food. And I had Slanted Door in my head for 10 years before I opened. My first job was with an English pub. I was busing table in Chinatown in an English pub. And my dad was a janitor, and we used to serve steak and kidney pie and with Watney. It's good stuff.
But I'd like to know, with the food that you were serving at Slanted Door, what do you think people were responding to?
I think you have to move the bar. I mean, you got to bring something new. I went to dinner last night, and I'm not going to name name. I had some quail and stuff with something, It was so boring, and it just bore out of my mind, and, you know, and it just, you can't be, if you're going to do that, either it's going to be executed perfectly, or you better bring something new to the table. Then again, you know, Thomas Keller could do a fried chicken, and everybody know a fried chicken is a perfect chicken, so you got to get them excited, but at the same time, you got to pull off. You got to bring it to a new place. As simple as a fried chicken, and everybody knows a fried chicken. They think they know fried chicken, but they really don't because they haven't really have the perfect fried chicken. You know, especially I've never been to the South, and when you get a perfect fried chicken, you go into a new place. I mean, obviously, you can't compare that to the Colonel. And okay, I'm getting into trouble here.
You're cut off. Joshua, what about for you? What are some qualities that you think makes good food great?
Well, I think the entire experience of eating can be one of the most central experiences that a human being can actually experience and indulge in. And just watching my son last week, we were eating a very simple kind of hole-in-the-wall Turkish dinner, and he ate something he had never eaten before. It was a watermelon salad with vinaigrette. And he is a five-year-old, and he literally closed his eyes and went, "Oh, my God." And for a young child to...
A young San Franciscan child.
to be that expressive, all of us have experienced that, where it can be, you know, just a piece of bread, you know, the most common fried chicken, whatever it is, and you're like, "Oh, my God, this is heavenly." And how can you complement that in all, whether it's the atmosphere that you're in, the lighting, the, you know, how can you touch all the senses, not to compete? I think it's, you're not trying to shout for attention, but you know when you've walked into a place, and food dominates, without a doubt. Food is the most important thing for a great restaurant.
So with that earlier percentage, what percentage would you weight it at?
Oh, 80, 20. I mean, I don't care how beautiful a restaurant is. If it's not amazing food, you're not staying. You're out of there. I mean, or once and you're out of there. But seriously, the question is then how to complement it respectfully in the design. And you all know you will go back and back and back when you have tasted something great. And you're in an environment that feels like home. And when I say home, it's a very large home where you feel at home and you don't want to leave. You just want to keep eating. So that's I would say, would be a great...
Well said. And on that note, so Paolo, do you think a restaurant can serve great food and just great food in order for people to deem the restaurant great? Or does there have to be a modicum of good service and atmosphere?
I mean, I guess it kind of depends on how you define great. I think, if we're talking kind of great restaurants like these guys, I think it's probably a complete package. But then again, there's plenty of restaurants that, you know, may be a little stripped down and still serve great food. I think best restaurants are very much a complete thought and functional in both design and food, and you know, it's almost like it's a work of art. It's functional, it's beautiful, it evokes emotion at its best.
So there's also a price component, and I'd like to hear from any of you. How does value come into play when assessing a great restaurant? Does it need to feel worth it to be great, or should there be times when money's no object? Let's start with you, Michael.
I feel like, yeah, it should always have a value, no matter you know, what restaurant you're going to or what experience you're after as a diner. When I'm going out to eat, I go to particular places with the mood I'm in, and that's why it's nice that I was able to open up two restaurants in one building because I felt like you get kind of pigeonholed into having a restaurant in San Francisco, and when we opened up the original restaurant and it was smaller, you still got the label of being expensive. And I felt like with the products that I was buying, you know, that was fine. I didn't really mind the tag, but I liked the ability to get a younger crowd, different folks into a different restaurant. And then, so, but no, I think as a chef and a restaurateur, you have to be very aware of that, of everything that goes into who's walking in the door. And it's very, very important that you recognize that.
Mm-hmm. And so, Charles, in your mind, how low could a restaurant go price-wise or ingredient quality-wise and still be great?
You know, price, you're gonna make some people happy. You're going to piss some people off, and that's just the territory. Some people come to my place and expect $2.99, and mine is $12.99, and... So it's really, at the end of the day, you could have value at Michael's restaurant, or you could have value in a, and it's all about expectation. I remember back before we left Valencia Street, we put on a $9 glass of Pinot because Mart, our wine guy, was just like, hey, why don't we open these really expensive Pinot and serve them by the glass because nobody can afford to buy the whole bottle. And I open it, and I get yelled at, and they drank half of it, and they want to return it because I did not know it was $9 Pinot. You know, this is about 7 years ago. They expect to pay $4 for a glass of wine, and we get yelled at. Great wine, but they didn't care. Expectation. I get down to the ferry building. We serve a $12 glass of Pinot, and I told a customer, or a waiter told a customer it's $12, and he gets all angry. He's like, I didn't ask for how much it is. Just bring me the wine. So there you go. You know, so expectation, that's why I call it slamming the door. You had no idea where you're going, you know. It's like never, never land. Everything's crooked. Prices is upside down. That's why I call it slamming the door, because I did not want people to expectation. People expected for me to serve tea for free, and they say every Chinese restaurant serves tea for free. And we were buying this stuff that more than the stuff you smoke. I mean, it was like $180 a pound. And we were the first guy to serve Chinese tea at $5 a pot in 1995, and the Ritz-Carlton was serving $2.50, and everybody else was $1 a pot. So there goes your price. Then again, I had to hold my ground because I was paying $180 a pound oolong coming out of China, and you can brew four times. I used to have a fight with these customers, and later on they become my best friend because they were like, every Chinese restaurant we know serve free tea. So price is a funny thing, and we constantly got to educate. You know, we buy commodity chicken at $1.60 a pound. We get Soul Food Farm. This is wholesale price, by the way. That's not the price you pay. This is the price I pay. You pay a lot more than that.
oh, really?
And Soul Food Farm was charging $4 a pound for chicken. These are the best chicken. And finally, she went out of business. She couldn't deal with it. $2 went to the slaughterhouse. Now, how do we know that chicken should be $1.60? Well, I think some company with a letter T decide to set that price and grow them in a big box. You get $1.60. So it's really our job to draw the line in the sand and say, look, maybe you shouldn't eat chicken, you know, six nights a week. This is what it costs. When I was kids in Vietnam, chicken's a big deal. You got to go get it. You got to cut its head off, slaughter it. It's expensive. It's not cheap. And we, you know, we can go on and on about pricing the food system in this country where we can buy ribeye at the price. So really, it's really upside down. But at the end of the day, you got to put value. You make your customer happy. And you have to, we're constantly sensitive to those things, depend on neighborhood. You know, we're about to open up the original location. We're not going to price, you know, $12, $15 Pinot. You know, maybe we'll hide them in the back. If you really ask for it, I'll bring it out.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit to service. So perhaps, Joshua, if you could talk to me about What are the components of service you need to see for a place to be great?
A writer once told me, and I have to commend her because it was a beautiful description. She said, great service is the responsibility of the diner walking in. If you walk in and you know what you want and you look your waiter in the eye and you ask very clearly what you want and tell them what you want and you treat them with respect, you will get great service. Flat out. It's yet to prove me wrong.
Really?
it's about respect. Truly, I really do think that if you treat somebody with absolute respect.
I know a waiter that stones out of their mind. I can't get them to do anything, and they're a loser. I'm sorry, Joshua. I don't really agree on that. Now, mind me, I do believe that you should be really respectful of the waiter, but sometimes you're going to get a bad one because.
How about you, Paolo? What are some components of service you like to see for a place to be great?
Well, I think it's kind of the opposite. Good service is good service. Most of the time you don't notice it. Sometimes you have a great waiter who you really enjoy, but you really notice the bad waiters. And like Charles said, I mean, there's just so many like little red flags that go up in dining. Like, you know,
Well, I do have to say there's one thing people don't realize. People think, you know, anybody can be a waiter. Everybody can open a restaurant. Waiter is the most taxing mental job, you know. You have to come to work, whatever your move is, you actually mentally get into the customer, connect with them, and it doesn't, even the best of the best, some night they just, whatever the ion is not connecting, it's bouncing off, and we, as a manager, will take them out, remove them, at the best intention. I mean, people don't realize this. There are people and there's energy that go across the room, and whatever reason there's bad and not like I said, there's bad waiter, just bad waiter. But there's time that you got to recognize it's a human being. This is not a machine, and you have to be respectful. It's a delicate balance, and our job is to have different team member to mitigate that and make sure. But at the end of the day, they don't really care. The customer is paying the bill. Mm. They got to have a good experience. And it's your job to make sure they're happy, whatever it takes.
And so, Michael, having one of the restaurants with some of the finest service in the city, I'd like to know, perhaps when you're out, does service have to be perfect in your mind for a restaurant to be great? What if you have a less than stellar experience with the host, which can be a common complaint these days, but a seamless experience with the server and the sommelier? How is that for you?
Myself, personally, when I'm going out to eat, everybody seems to think that chefs are super critical when they're outside of a restaurant, and that when I'm going out, I'm out to enjoy myself at a restaurant, and I'm not really like, unless it's like an experience at a place that I've really wanted to go for years, and then I may like judge it a little bit differently, but I try to relax, and that's not what I'm about personally when I go out to eat. But for somebody coming to my own restaurant, luckily my wife Lindsay runs the floor and I'm not to be seen in the front of the house of the restaurant. I think everything is important from, like I spoke about earlier, from the moment that the guest walks in the door, and that I think it's just there's a general theme from, like, I didn't really get to talk about your question regarding the food earlier. I think I wanted to say was that as long as you have, like, an honest approach to what you're doing and what you're cooking, and you know, you feel confident in what you're doing day in, day out, regardless of the price issue, then I think you can walk away from the job at the end of the night knowing that you're doing the best you can. And I think there's that overlaying kind of thinking in the restaurant that you, regardless of food or service or the decor, you always have to, it's a business based upon making adjustments, not only on a, you know, monthly basis, but on a daily basis, you're really just kind of adjusting to everything that's going on in your restaurant. And the same thing goes for the guests that are coming in regarding service. You really have to adjust to, you know, some guests may not want to have any interaction whatsoever with the restaurant or the server or the maitre d' or myself. And then you have, it's just every night it's a little bit different. And, I think, I personally like it when I'm able to meet guests that are enjoying themselves and want to talk about, you know, food and wine and service and decor and art and everything. That's what makes it a really interesting job compared to, you know, if I was just in the kitchen every night. You know, it's kind of a grind every now and then. And then that's what makes a job exciting, is to go out and see somebody actually enjoying themselves. And so.
Nice. So another component is atmosphere. And Joshua, I'd like to hear, what is it about the atmosphere at certain restaurants that makes them great? What comes to mind?
Well, again, going back to the sensual quality, I think there's a potential to make a really remarkable experience for everyone dining in a restaurant. And it takes to obtain that connection with the chef, it takes a great deal of communication, because every restaurant is completely unique. And to kind of just carry over one idea to the next would be kind of insulting to the concept of each individual restaurant. So I think there's a synergy between the designer and the owner, chef, that needs to come out, a real voice and a perspective and an honesty. And I think that's the reason that Michael and Charles have been so successful is they have been incredibly honest about the food that they're presenting and the spaces that they are presented in. And there's a beauty in that. I think it's seen.
It kind of ties into a question I had for you later, which is there kind of a design equivalent of a mission statement that you do for your clients? And, you know, how do you work with them to arrive at a design direction? That's for you.
Well, that's for me.
I'm a cook.
The mission statement does come from the owner, and we don't create the mission statement. We're basically responding on all different levels. I mean, we design to all five senses. It's a very collaborative process, a very exciting process. But a lot of it's about distilling ideas that are extraneous and really kind of extracting the most potent of the ideas and really understanding how the human being engages in space. Going to a restaurant is one of the most voyeuristic aspects living, you know, in the city. And I think that's tremendously underestimated, that, you know, it's a pleasure, it's a treat, it's a privilege to go out to a restaurant and eat. And how do you engage that social act, and how do you promote that social act while also providing, simultaneously providing kind of privacy to have that private meal, whether it's a singular person or a family or friends. So that's that duality of incredibly public and incredibly personal and private that is the great challenge.
I think he's underselling himself, but I think it's not so much a mission statement. It's really a partnership. And I work with, not with Joshua, I work with Ole Lundberg, and we have worked on 6-7 restaurants. And it's really Ole had worked with Michael, worked with a lot of other restaurateurs. It's really the two partnership get together. They get your character of the place based on location, a lot of other things that dictate that. Not just what I say, the temple of the restaurant, the price point, and you talk about different things. Then the architect, you know, put together a package and they show it to you, and you might go edit here a little bit and say, well, I need a bigger bar because I need to serve cocktail or whatnot. And then you go to, but really, it's a partnership of, because since we're not architect, we don't have those language to put it out in these form, but often the space itself sort of usually dictate some of these elements, the grid line, how big the kitchen is. So when I work it, I usually deal with the nuts and bone okay, I gotta have more kitchen, and my sister's like, well, more dining room. Of course, we're fighting it, but usually the grid of the building usually dictates some of these things, and the architect come and sort of like the mediator in between, and but it's very much part of the architect and the owner, and it is not, you know, if they could have done themselves, they could have just hired a contractor and start building, so they don't. So.
So how do you design a place to stand the test of time? We were talking about that a little bit earlier before the panel. How do you create something timeless like a Chez Panisse, which is turning 40, or Zuni? You know, they've been refreshed, but their style endures. What are your thoughts on that?
I can take that one.
Yeah.
I think the restaurants that endure like that over like 40 years is a pretty amazing feat for any business, and a restaurant even more so. So I think it's interesting because when you sit down, like we sat down for the first restaurant with my mother-in-law, we just sat in an empty restaurant basically that we purchased and said, what do you want to do here? But we did it in such a way that like it didn't have like a restaurants that have too much of a thematic element to them where a designer has taken over and has just like done everything at the restaurant that I feel like they get really old really kind of quickly, and you have to leave, like put a certain amount of yourself into it all the time because you're going to be at the restaurant all the time. So I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why I feel like, you know, we were able to succeed was because it didn't feel like, you know, somebody just kind of came in and put their stamp on what's going to be your, like, house for the most part for the next number of years than that. I think sometimes less is more regarding a restaurant. And I actually love the Bar Agricole site. I think is like it's amazing. It's got so many interesting. You know, I was there on Sunday for brunch, and you know, you're just like kind of looking up at the, you know, just all around. It's just an amazing like experience, and it works, and you feel really comfortable. And at the same time, you don't feel like you know. You give yourself a little bit of room, maybe if you want to tinker a little bit with it. In some restaurants, I feel like when it's not the owners that are in charge, or they don't have a good trust base with their client, that you know you're going to get bored really kind of quickly. And I feel like if you're going to get bored with your own restaurant, then your clients, the people that are going to come in and eat at your restaurant, are going to get bored even sooner. Mm. So,
but I don't think sometimes design it's just. If the food is not there and you don't have the business, in case of Zuni and Chez Panisse, the business continues to thrive. There's a lot of innovation in the food. They might change the dining a little bit. I mean, those, you know, Chez Panisse is basically like a craftsman home. Mm-hmm. If you just take that alone, I don't think it's going to make it, you know. But it's really, it's a living thing, and sometimes it just become the parts that play that. But granted, often these good restaurants are one that lasts a long time, great bone, great light, great scale. But usually the business, it falter and the food is not there and you start collapsing, or the neighborhood. Star was an example back in the old days where you have this, you know, street and it was just thriving. I remember busing table back then and saving up money to go and eat a little cafe at Star. And you would never imagine that would go away, but yet that thing, you know, like Trader Vic comes in and nothing really works there. So I think a lot of time the longevity of those is really the people that live in it, the food, and the continue to innovate. I think if you don't innovate and change, it gets old and you lose your owner, and the owner's not there. In the case of Starter, I think it was sort of like when Jeremiah left. So it's been a while now. It's just kind of crumbled. But I remember back in the 80s, man, that was just hot. And yet today, it just, you know, I don't know how many generation restaurant went through that. Great Bone could have their design. Anyway, it ain't going to happen.
Mm. Which kind of ties into, I think, the X factor of certain restaurants. Beyond the food and the atmosphere and the service, you know, what is it? What are some examples of some great places that you think have that certain je ne sais quoi? Paolo?
I mean, That's a tricky question, too. No, I think the best places with that, those intangibles, I mean, they all have a point of view. And whether that's in the atmosphere or in the food, like, you see a point of view. And most of the time, you agree with the point of view if you like it. But, I mean, I think that intangible thing is the most important. I mean, you love a restaurant that has soul, that, you know, you have some, you know, like Joshua was saying, it evokes some emotion. But eating is also just, as a diner, I mean, I think I'm one of the only guys on the other side of the table here. You know, you kind of, it's about the experience, too, and it's about who you're dining with. It's the experience of eating, so, I don't know. But I think soul and that mm-hmm. point of view is so important.
And what would be your thoughts on how much does the dining experience need to be groundbreaking in order to be great? I mean, Charles, you started a little bit of a discussion about that with the importance of innovation.
Well, if you're brand new, you got to bring something new to the table. But at the same time, I can think of all these example restaurants been around. I mean, how many people went to House of Prime Rib? I mean, still. I mean, we can talk about the design. It looks like the pub that I used to work in. You know, but it fulfill a niche in the marketplace, and it fulfill a value. You know, they do that funny salad. They spin the bowl and that little motor underneath. You know, and I always look to those and study those things, like why it works and not. Yes, I think no doubt today, if you want to be a new player, you better bring something new to the table. You can't just, you know, do the same old. If you do the same old, it better be, like, perfect. I think just, and people are funny in the restaurant. They want the same old thing, but they want innovation at the same time. People come to my restaurant and like, I don't know how many shaken beef I made, and I'm so sick of it. But I have to make it. But at the same time, we try to make new dishes so that I think the minute we stop, I think we'll die. That's just really, but at the same time, if they took, you know, months to get a reservation, they show up, I don't have shaking beef, oh, boy, they just let me out.
And so, Joshua, what do you think San Francisco's relationship is with innovation, and how important is that quality here compared to restaurants in perhaps other cities?
Well, I think it's a great question about innovation versus, or in addition to timelessness, because you would think they would be opposing. But in fact, if you really, I think just modern architecture in general, we live in the 20th century, we should be designing for the 20th century, and we should be eating food of the 20th century. But we always look back for inspiration. So I think there's just immense potential to innovate. But I think there's ways to do it which you're always touching back to what it is to be human. And everyone picks up on that. And you can be, you know, I think the danger, and I think Charles hinted on it, or Michael, is you're not looking to be trendy. You're not looking to be themed. You're looking to innovate honestly. And people will feel it, and people will come.
So, Michael, as someone who's done some traveling, how are the great restaurants of San Francisco different than the great restaurants of other cities?
You know, I like I was telling you earlier when we were in the green room, we were all saying that, like, as a chef, it's interesting because you don't really get to dine out in the city that you have a restaurant in as much as you would like, so. Until this past year, I didn't really get to go to too many new restaurants that opened up. Friends that opened up restaurants over the years, I hadn't gotten to them. And just because you're working a lot, so you don't really have the ability to dine out as much. And Charles and Joshua were talking about you know, having families and not being able to want to eat a certain kind of way. So I feel like the restaurants that I've tried recently, you know, that I really remember are a couple new ones. I had a great experience at Bennu. That was really something, a really clear, concise vision of a younger chef. That was probably the most impressive meal that I've had compared to restaurants in Europe. They're just different, you know. You don't have the pressure, I think, in Europe to have multiple seatings in an evening. It's just you're cooking for a certain amount of people, and I think as a chef you want to cook like that, and I think that's what led me to open up the first kind of restaurant, to have a smaller restaurant. But then, you know, you need to figure out how to make a living in the city, and then you kind of change and make some adjustments and try to stay at your core values. But in Europe, it's definitely the sad thing I think about San Francisco is you don't really have you can still go to some lunch experiences that are really amazing in European cities, and there's not that availability, I think, if you want to have somewhat of a special experience. Even in New York, it seems to be kind of dying out a little, the lunchtime. Got friends in from town, you really want to take them to someplace special. There's not as many options around, but I think San Francisco, compared to European restaurants, is definitely, there are some great new restaurants, and even today I was speaking to some friends. They were thinking about moving, and they were in the restaurant business, from a great restaurant in New York, and they were saying that there was an excitement in San Francisco, and they wanted to get out of the East Coast, and that San Francisco was the place to come to. So I don't think they would have said the same thing maybe 2-3 years ago. And I think that's great that there's a lot of younger, talented people opening up restaurants that are doing some really exciting, mm-hmm. great things.
How do you balance what's your take, both of you, in terms of balancing that innovation versus the business thing? Because, I mean, you mentioned that.
You just throw her out there and see what sticks. Yeah, I mean, you won't know until you try. I'm about to open my original location. We'll see if I fail. But also, I think, you know, I travel. In fact, you know, I'm going to get on the plane heading to Taipei right after this. So I was just in Beijing and Shanghai, and the whole aesthetic in China is completely different, and their growth. And there's a restaurant. You know, everybody get escorted into the little room. It looks like apartment. I was hosted by local friends, and she was all excited. She said, "I got you a room. We even have our own bathroom." And it looks like an apartment with, like, really bad air conditioning. I was really hot. And for them, it was really a big deal in China, you know, get your private room. I want to be in the room where I see everybody. But so I think aesthetic is very different, and style of food. At the same time, you know, in Japan, having sushi chef, you know, have this wall that's made out of sand, and there's no painting on the wall, and you're supposed to look at this wall that's like the stucco job is just like supposedly really amazing, and the piece of wood that's sitting there, and it was rubbed by, I was with my architect, it was rubbed by river mud, it was just voluptuous. It's really different. At the same time, you know, we had great chicken noodle soup in Hanoi on a trip. So, you know, I think for when people say, what's a good restaurant? I think first thing, they're like all these apps and stuff. I think it should come with a bunch of questions before I say anything, you know. Are you going on a date? Are you going to propose to somebody? Are you just like in Jean? Like, where are you at, you know? And to bring somebody to Michael restaurant when they're not ready and they're not in the mode, they're not going to be happy, it's just vice versa. So I think, how do you define that? And I often, us chef could sift through all that. Talk about great service. I mean, I can pinpoint bad service in a hole-in-the-wall place just as well. I have bad service at a fancy place. And it's all measured with different ruler. They're not the same. And for diner, you just have to measure the right ruler. I mean, you can't expect in a hole-in-the-wall place the guy come over all the time. You know, you just got to ask him for water. You know, don't expect him to come by itself. But if he doesn't come over a few times, then you bad service. You know, so I think it's also consumer has to be educated and also be open to try these things, you know. And I was really, I mean, it was this Beijing Peking duck place. It was just packed, and I really tried. I mean, normally I would not enjoy sitting in a room with just my friend, and it would have bad air conditioning.
So we're going to be taking questions soon, so please start lining up at the mic now if you have one. We talked about this a little bit earlier as well, offline. Let's touch upon people in the industry versus the general public. Is there a difference in what these two groups perceive to be a great restaurant? Joshua. Or maybe some of the things that you notice that are different.
Well, I can't speak for the general public necessarily. Well, I'm going to pass that question on to really.
Hot potato? No.
I think it just depends upon, you know, who you are and what your values are regarding food and what you really want to, what you're looking for when you go out you may go to a new place that's got a, more molecular style cuisine that's fairly moderately priced, and if that's a great experience to you, then I totally appreciate that. I going back to the innovation question that you spoke about earlier, it's like I think something that some people don't really ever want to talk about is like not everybody wants to just innovate, be really super innovative, and I don't think it makes a restaurant may make it exciting for a short period of time, but I think if you combine some tradition and some innovation, that combination can be just as interesting and give you a little bit more of a long-term survival in the restaurant business if you grow over time. And that's the hard thing about opening a restaurant, whether you're 22 or 40 or whatever, you're constantly up against that first review and the challenges of what's going to happen. And I think as long as you really feel confident in what you're doing, you can offer just a style of food that appeals to people, and it doesn't always have to be innovative. As you know, it can have great technique and at the same time have little underlying elements of being innovative. But I never set out to do anything really like innovative. I just wanted to cook. I got all my inspiration from going to a small, restaurant in the middle of Piedmont that was in a basement and of an old bank, but the food was lighter and more elegant than everything else that I had when I was in that region, and that kind of spoke to me about what I wanted to do when I came back to San Francisco. Was just
I don't think you have to be innovative and put foam call innovation. Your innovation is finding out, seeing the beauty of this particular food and finding ways to get it here. And for me, a lot of time innovation, it's just much of a craft. Like for me, cooking is not like I'm some high-priced artist that you should pay me to do this. It's really about a craft that you do, and you got have innovation to figure out how to get this craft back from Italy and produce here on Pacific Street Avenue. So innovation doesn't have to be like the latest gadgetry with nitrogen making ice cream. Could be, for me, that's why I think good bone restaurant like Chez Panisse, they are innovate. And to me, it's like continue the wow you of finding ingredient, it could be like trying to find that peach from some guy that none of us know or that, berry. So I don't see innovation as always like the latest gadgetry, but at the end of the day, it's just the product you deliver. Mm-hmm. But one thing I want to say about the universal about service, at the end of the day, fancy or not, if someone care, it could be a little hole-in-the-wall place, you will feel the love and everything's all cool. When they don't care, a fancy place, they didn't want to serve. I was just in Portland. They closed at midnight, and it was 12:40, and they said, I got to order your food in 2 minutes. And I thought it was 12 o'clock, and he didn't want to serve me. So we were just didn't have any love, and it was just everything tastes bad. The fruit tastes bad. The drink tastes bad, and we got out of there. So there you go. I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's about love and care. If somebody care, and you can see her, she's crazy, can't get her table, can't get her stuff, but she's constantly looking in your eye like, oh, my God, I can't get this thing. I'm in the weed. So I think that's really, have to nail that down to is if somebody on it, you will even forgive how lame they are and because they know they care. But when they don't care, that's it. That's it. You're done.
So as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting SF's James Beard Award winners, What Makes a Restaurant Great, with restaurant owners, chefs, designers, and journalists, Joshua Adlin, Charles Spann, Michael Tusk, and Paolo Lucchese. I'm Marcia Gagliardi, founder of the weekly e-column TableHopper.com and author of The Tablehopper's Guide to Dining and Drinking in San Francisco. And now let's go to audience questions. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, few cities in the world have such an incredible confluence of technology and food, and technology has had an impact in all of your careers for everyone on the panel. And so my question to the panel is, what advice would you give someone like myself who has years of business development and technical product development experience, who's also incredibly passionate about food, cooking, restaurants, and just the overall food industry? You know, what suggestions, where should you start? What advice would you give someone like myself who's looking to get into the industry?
Never put music on your restaurant website.
That's a good one.
Can we cut off the flat, no flash intros, no PDF menus? Please give me a cross street.
I can take that one if you'd like.
Go for it.
Get the real experience. Go volunteer, work at a restaurant. See if you, whether it's in the front or the back of the house. You know, I get that all the time. Like, somebody's dined at the restaurant. Their son wants to go to culinary school. He wants to be in the kitchen, this and that. And the reality is, like we were just talking about earlier, it's basically, you know, 90% of your day, you know, for the first number of years of your career is like you're in a kitchen and it is like a lot of manual kind of labor. So, get it. If you really have a passion for it, then go work for somebody. If you know a friend, you can just, you know, even if it's for, you know, a week, spend some time in the business. See if you still feel that passionate about it. And that'll be the biggest, you know, with the advent of all these culinary schools, you know, there's so many people that are coming into the industry. But I think it's few and far between when, I mean, you get a lot of really talented people that are walking into, whether it's your restaurant, kitchen, or the front. But there's a lot of people coming out of schools that I think they might have just gone to school because they couldn't figure out exactly what to do, and they'll be out of the business very quickly, because if your heart's not in it, then it'll, you know, you'll have an experience like maybe Charles, waiter in whatever city that was. I don't want him to. I don't want.
Well, If I may add, I think the tech industry could learn something from us regarding service. I'm getting into more trouble. What I mean by that is user interface. You know, often technology don't think of the. You know, I think just like all great design, user interface, the human experience, that's where it's key. And you can already see the different search engine, the different searches, location services of these app when they don't do it right. And people go around in circle. People use less of those services, you know, because as more and more where I see that technology is, you know, you get into Portland, let's find coffee. You're like, I just got off the plane. I had no idea where I am. Where do you find that, you know, coffee, all that stuff. But a lot of people don't, you know, we come from the service. We think the minute we see you, we think of everything. We are trying to anticipate what's your next mood. You know, are you cranky? Do you want me to leave you alone for a few more minutes? That sort of thing. I think that's sort of advice I would say.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. In our modern restaurant worlds, how important is the pre-opening buzz and the PR to really making a restaurant get off on its right footing, especially in our town?
Paolo?
I mean, it's only important if it's a good... I mean, it's obviously, it can... It's a double-edged sword, I think, because if it's not a good restaurant, it's kind of all for naught. It's like, you know, full of sound and fury. Signify nothing, but I mean, I guess it's important. What do you guys think?
If I were you, spend your time in the kitchen. Don't worry about that stuff. You know, because, like, for me, I try to hide and don't tell people I'm owning a restaurant so I can open and take my time and maybe only a few customers come up and I can get my kinks out of the way. I think that at the end of the day, you know, it's the product. If you can get the buzz. I was fortunate enough in the early year, we got the buzz going really early. You hit the sweet spot, but I just know from experience of people opening restaurants, they never have enough money. They usually shorts, and I think having a great product and once you get on the road and you're more exposed, then you start reaching out to the PR folks and so on. But I think in the beginning, when you don't have any money, just work on the food and the service.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The first 5 years when we opened, we didn't have anybody that did any PR, and I totally understand what Charles was saying. And then, because you can't usually afford it if you're, you know, this was, you know, almost 7 or 8 years ago, we couldn't afford it, so we didn't have any PR for years. And then it just kind of came naturally, and then that was a great kind of sign. And then as you seem to kind of mature as a restaurant, then it becomes kind of more important. And, like, I've seen both signs, both sides, where it wasn't really necessary, but then you kind of think back on some things that you might have, like, could have been helpful for your business and your employees, that you could have spread the word about a couple things. And so now I see both sides of the spectrum, that I feel like, you know, if you're able to work with somebody that you trust and you respect, and you feel like they really want to work with you, then I feel like it's it can be a great fit, and then you can actually really it can work really well for a restaurant. But at the beginning, I feel like you know, there's a lot of pressure on young chefs and restaurateurs, and from the moment that you open up a restaurant these days, it's like there's a lot of little things to kind of deal with. So I can also see why somebody would want to, if you could afford it economically, to get off the ground, and having a small amount of PR help to have you navigate through the terrain of you know, opening up for the first 6 months. But I definitely see both sides.
But you don't need PR for pre-opening buzz as well. I mean, I think, you know, Charles and I met a couple weeks ago, and that was his pre-opening buzz.
Yeah. Well, also nowadays with all the different media,
yeah.
I think also if you could, you know, if your friend's a PR person, you can trade for like 2 dinner once a week and, you know, whatever, you know. But at the end of the day, I'm just speaking from experience of restaurateur opening, even with big budget, usually, you know, you're kind of short on cash, so.
Thank you.
What is such a significant percentage of the current restaurants so damn noisy? And this certainly wasn't the... sometimes it's noisy at the point of being painful, and this certainly wasn't the case in the city, as I recall, 40 or 50 years ago. I've often thought about starting a restaurant called the Quiet Restaurant. I want to ask Mr. Adlin, do you consider acoustics when you're designing these restaurants?
Absolutely, and they're absolutely right. The first thing that gets cut out of that budget is the sound, the acoustics. It's painful because we warn them, and then they say, well, we can't afford it. We have to, you know, put the walls up first, you know. And we're like, we can't disagree there, but it's very important, and we cannot agree more. I mean, it's
also
paramount.
20 years ago, everybody got tablecloth, and it's not hip to have tablecloth these days. So, for some of us,
also,
you know, for a certain type of restaurants, so that's you know, you're adding to the clanging, the noise. I don't think there's a single restaurateur saying, "Let's make this thing noisy." It's usually come to budget. And in our case, at the Ferry Building, there was a lot of glass on the wall. We did not want a tablecloth because we're come from the mission. We want to transfer some of that sort of edgy, you know, neighborhood flavor. So it's a design decision, and also it's a financial decision. Tablecloth budget is probably about $100,000 a year, so just on tablecloth. I mean, you still get the napkins, but
thank you.
Hi, I had a question. particularly for Charles and Michael, with regard to choosing a location, the neighborhood that you're going to be starting your restaurant in. What was your experience like picking a location, and what was it like, especially for you, Michael, picking a location that wasn't necessarily known initially for restaurants, and what that experience was like, and what it was like after you moved to, I guess, a more traditional location?
I could literally drive around the city, and like I spent a year looking at everything and anything at that time period, because I'd been out of work for maybe like 8 or 10 months, and so I just looked at anything that was available all around San Francisco, and I can drive around now with friends and show them spots that I looked at that I actually liked for 24 to 36 hours, and then I go by them now, and I'm like, thank God I never took that place over. So it's, you know, I've got a lot of friends, like some people that used to work for me that are looking for restaurant spots, and I try to guide them through the process. But you just have to go with something that you feel like, hey, fits your business plan, and you're going to be successful in it. And I think a trap for some younger chefs is to just take a spot that you know, you're going to get. It's going to, a couple years down the road, may not be exactly what you thought it was going to be. You're not going to be able to grow in it. And so that was, you know, I don't want to say that was us in a nutshell, but it was a small, you know, building from the 1890s, and I liked my time that I spent there, but I couldn't really do anything at a certain point, and it was an older building, and there was a ton of repairs, and at one point I tried to move the kitchen from the location that it was in to a different location, and that would have cost like a staggering amount of money, and I would have maybe gained like 8 or 10 seats at the end of the day. So I wasn't looking to move to Pacific Avenue. It just kind of like it came to us, and somebody offered it to us, and then I feel like it's the kind of business you need to take a, whether it's your first restaurant or your second restaurant or your like 10th, you need to take a roll the dice, and you know, it's going to be risky no matter what, wherever you are. It's never a sure bet, no matter how talented you may be, and you just have to take a chance and kind of make it happen and have the be strong-willed enough to really want to be at a new spot or an older spot. And I think the best advice I could give for anybody is to, you know, it's got to work for you, and you got to envision yourself in the restaurant for, you know, a number of hours a day for, you know, a very long time.
Yeah, so. The key thing is also you got to be honest, you know. Obviously you want to be in Union Square, but you can't afford it now, so you have to settle for, you know, Glen Park. So, but Glen Park is you have to be realistic. You're not going to get lunch, so you're going to count on dinner only, and it's all down budget. When I got from my first spot of Valencia Street, my rent was $2,000, and I didn't even know I can get a permit for it, but I got enough money to pay rent for a year. I pulled the trigger. I jumped in front of everybody else. They were like, wondering if they're going to sign the lease. I just made the deal right there and came back in 10 minutes and gave the landlord a check. So sometimes you just got to go with your gut and see how much you can risk, but also be realistic, you know, like, and over time, and once you get a little bit more secure, you can say, all right, that's going to have a lunch business like the Fair Building, and you're going to wing at dinner. You're going to use your attraction to get dinner. So location, obviously, is very important, but I think lastly you want to think about is how much money you're going to spend and the return. When Craig at Delfina opened his first place, he stayed the same time, but his first place was like 25 seat, you know. I mean, 25 seat, if you don't cook and you have to hire a cook, I mean, there's no way that math's going to come out, because back then Craig has to cook, but he didn't have somebody else work for him. I did the same thing. In the beginning, I cook and my brother wait table. So, but we have more seat than that. So you got to think about, you can't have everything in the beginning. So I think it's just your bandwidth, how much you're willing to, and be realistic about your projection and get somebody else to look at it also.
Yeah, that's what I was going to recommend. Definitely bring an architect to see the site, because we toured probably 10 different restaurants or locations on two restaurants, and it really will help. It'll pay for it in the long run, because they can value. You know, they can see what's coming, the amount of infrastructure you're bringing in. And we ended up opening two restaurants in the least likely place, Crack Central on 16th Street and Crack Double Central on 11th, and they're both incredibly successful. So it really depends on the bones of the building and creative people and incredible chefs to make pull it off.
Crack cocktails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Curious about how, related to service and technology, how you guys handle user-generated content with, you know, your Yelps, your Open Tables, your all the stuff going on with tweeting, liking, all that kind of thing. How do you handle all that?
Why don't you take that one?
I don't really pay attention to it. I the person I value the most is really my regular. I mean, I got people complaining that my napkin get too much lint on their lap, and but I want a cotton napkin. I don't want a polyester, so I really don't. And when I don't have a real, you know, I you know, the one I worry about most is really the regulars that comes in all the time, and if they don't get a dish, and we can, you know, and we usually know ourselves, but it's hard when you. There's so much of it, it's just heartbreaking to read it, and I go crazy at night, and I don't sleep, you know.
For all we try to do is, and I don't like to, like Charles said, I can't really read most of a lot of that. You know, even I think as a chef and a restaurant owner, you don't really believe a lot of what's written. The really complimentary stuff, I never really get too high about it, and then negative stuff. You try to kind of like not really, you know, take, you know, you try to learn from it if you actually think like there's a trend and you can read something like, you know, the fish cook is, you know, as the fish is salty or something, you read something and you keep track of it. But I personally don't do it. You try to have somebody in your business that keeps track of it because you want to have an honest dialogue with the guest. If the hard part for me is when, you know, you read a lot of, or you'll have somebody in your business read something, and then, you know, it's nice when a restaurant guest, they have an issue that, you know, I think chefs in particular may be a little bit more difficult to talk to, but, you know, I think directly calling a restaurant and speaking to them if you have an issue regarding something is I think you'll get a better result sometimes than just, you know, taking a restaurant to task about something, and then because it's not just like the restaurant, it's like all the employees that are working there and everybody else that's involved in the entire operation that. And I like it when I do get guest feedback, but I get it directly from somebody, and if they have an issue, I'd love to talk to them about it and have an honest conversation. And occasionally I will call somebody and try to talk to them about something that might have come up. So
thank you for your questions. We're now asking all of our speakers the following question. Joshua, Charles, Michael, and Paolo, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? Signore?
Well, smart people should do more things. Dumb people should do less things.
Here, here. Michael.
Yeah, I can honestly say I've never really thought about what I'm changing the world. I'd, you know, be nice to see people eat in a more healthy fashion, supporting local, you know, farmers and people that are. My biggest thing when I got into the restaurant business was, and that I tell everybody that works for me, is that if you think you're working a lot in the kitchen, then put yourself in the shoes of like a small farmer, and then because that's a life that's super difficult and hard and can be changed at the you know in one stroke of some weather. So, if anything, I'd like to, you know, that would be it.
Charles.
Well, maybe you should cook at home more often.
Unexpected.
And then you like me more, yeah.
Brilliant. Joshua?
I would say education. That if the world is truly educated and they're truly well-fed, and aware of each other, you won't have the disgraces that are falling upon so many millions and millions of people in the world.
Thank you. So let's give a big round of applause to Joshua Adelin. Our guests tonight, Joshua Adelin, Charles Fand, Michael Tusk, and Paolo Lucchese. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. That's the best answer.